Welcome to the Marketing Phoenix podcast, where my guest and I will give you our best growth strategies for marketing that leads to sales. My name is Melissa Rogozinski, and I'll be your host.
Today, I am delighted and excited to have Isha Marath, law and technology reporter for ALM Media, as our guest. Welcome, Isha.
Thank you so much for having me. This is really exciting, and I was glad to be invited by you.
You have stirred a hornet's nest, and I can't wait to get into it. So, Isha, before we get started, would you mind telling our audience just a little bit about yourself and your career?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm currently, of course, the tech reporter for ALM on Legal Tech News. And we do a lot of stories, as I'm sure you guys have seen. It's a really small but incredible team at LTN. And we do podcasts as well. So kind of a multimedia approach to tech news within legal. And pre-ALM, I was in college and I was freelancing for local newspapers in Boston. Yeah, that's kind of how it went.
Excellent. Excellent. Thank you, Isha. So before we dive in, I just want to remind our audience to please click the follow button and subscribe to our Apple podcast. It's brand new, so we need to get our subscribers up. And please don't forget to share your favorite episodes with your peeps and tag RPC Strategies. So for our audience, I kind of hinted to it earlier, Isha and I are going to discuss an article that she recently wrote and set in motion a movement that has been stirring for a while. This hornet's nest has been building up for a while, and Isha just unapologetically kicked it and stirred up the hornet's nest. So we are calling out the proverbial boys club and championing women in legal tech and AI. And disclaimer, I do want to say that I and many other women in tech and legal, we have had lots of men throughout our career that have supported us and encouraged us. But there is still a pretty big issue, and we want to dig into what the issue is. But more than that, we want to talk about solutions to that, because we're past the point of just talking about it. We need to take action and do something about it. So, Isha, you start your article by citing the Boys Club. Okay, so what prompted you to write this article to begin with?
Well, a little background, I suppose, just with the impact of the article, or even what you're saying right now about kicking the hornet's nest. I really didn't think it would be that big a deal. Like, I really thought these are conversations we've been having for some time, and especially since the Me Too movement, and even before that, of course, but most recently. So I was surprised at, you know, I got a lot of good feedback, and then some, a little bit of backlash as well, you know, which is to be expected. But it all started off of a LinkedIn post. I believe it was originally the top 100 legal tech influencers list, or AI influencers list. And I think it was Bob Ambrosi who first kicked it off. And then, you know, one thing led to another. And then folks were commenting on it and remarking on the general lack of diversity, and especially gender-based diversity, on that list. And you know, we saw Nikki Shaver and Nikki Black and many, many women in legal tech who have been in this industry far longer than I've been reporting on it, and who understand it far better than I understand it. And, you know, they basically said, hey, like, where are all the women? And I thought, oh, that's interesting. And I thought that generative AI is so new that it would be cool and valuable to look at how gender disparity in voices begins at kind of the nascent stage of a business, a venture, which is generative AI. So, yeah.
So let's talk about the Legal Tech Boys Club. What is it? Can you define that, or how has it been defined?
So according to our reporting, it's really, I'm sure, you know, I don't want to generalize for all women, but for many women, I'm sure, you know, you're familiar with being in a classroom and the teacher asks a question and it's just, and you just kind of second guessing yourself and you're like, I think I know, or I'm not quite sure I know. And you know, by the time you even decide whether to raise your hand or not, there's like six guys who raise their hands and you're like, oh my God, why didn't I just do that? And why didn't I just, you know, why didn't I speak up? So to me, as I understand the Boys Club in legal tech, it's not, you know, vindictive or purposeful, or, you know, it's not like mean guys trying to keep the women out. I really think it's that sort of internalized fear of raising your hand that creates this sort of echo chamber, which is just guys kind of lifting up each other, you know, and the women get left out, as they always have.
I think, you know, and I'm going to piggyback on that. I've seen that throughout my career. And I'm just a few years older than you. I've been in this career just a little bit longer than you. And I come from a culture in Alabama that, you know, really, you know, kind of held on to this message. And I was raised in an environment like that, like many other women. In college, I wrote a paper about breaking the glass ceiling, and I interviewed an executive, a female executive at a bank about it, and did really well. So I think, and I have seen that it depends on what environment you're raised in, what culture, because I've also met women my age who were raised in cities like New York or somewhere in Europe or other places where that ideal, that stereotypical ideal of the what a woman should be personally and professionally and what a man should be personally and professionally. And we were discouraged actively to not be, I know I was, but a lot were in certain environments were discouraged to not be strong, not speak up, to let the man lead. We were discouraged to not be strong. But then there's others, like I said, in New York, Europe, and, you know, who were raised, or in California, were raised in different environments that were, or in different economic situations, who were encouraged to, you know, go and get, you know, multiple degrees and doctorate degrees and, you know, be very accomplished and provide for themselves. And it was okay to be single and not have children as a woman and be strong, to be a leader. And so I think it has a lot to do with the environment someone is raised in, the culture, and maybe a little bit the decade in which you were born and raised, right? But I've also seen with your generation more of a balance of that equality, of gender equality. I've got lots of friends in your age range, and, you know, it's really exciting to be who I am in my space in legal and see the younger generation like you, and to be a part of working with generations that are, you know, 10 or 20 years behind me. I see more of a balance of equality between the genders in your generation. And so I've had conversations like the one we're having, or I'm in a book club where I live and there's a young man who's, you know, 10 or 12 years younger. And we just read a book about the 1960s and gender inequality, and he didn't get it. But I understand why generations one or two behind me, because I'm seeing progress. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing more of a balance. So this is a really good conversation for us to have, because I think it's environment, it's culture, and generational. And I do see it changing, and I do see it improving. And I see your generation taking the lead on that. So I'm going to say thank you.
Well, that's, it's really interesting to get your perspective. And, you know, something I'm curious about is, what did you think reading the article, and why did you choose it for the webinar? You know, what was, I guess I ask because going back to the beginning of our conversation, you know, and I was surprised that it was a surprising article. And I guess I'm curious about your views since you understand the industry in so many more ways than I understand it.
Sure, no, and thanks for the question. I saw it the same way that you described it. I saw it through LinkedIn feeds. And Joy Holly, who is a good friend of mine and consulted with me for a while, I just interviewed her on, because she wrote two articles about it. And she listed me along with several other women that she said should be on stage in legal tech and talking about AI. And it was at the exact same time that I had an article that I wrote about copyright issues in AI. Because a lot of the news that's coming out right now is all about the funding and the technology and integrations. And there's been some chatter about, you know, usage issues or legal issues with it, but it's been overshadowed. And so I wrote this article about it because it has an impact on the type of business I do. And I was getting a lot of attention from that too. I was actually in the process of giving my own podcast with Jared Correa, which was being produced by Above the Law, on my article when Joy's came out. And that's when I saw all the feed. And then it led the cookie crumb trail led me to your article and this proverbial boys club. And I mean, I've known about that boys club my entire professional career. So it's nothing new to me. But like I said earlier, I come from a culture that did not encourage women like me to be who we are. And I'm not in that anymore, but, and I've got a successful career, but I have seen, like I said, the progress in the balance of equality, but it's in the generations after my own. And you're the generation that's going to be leading us professionally in this industry. You're the generation that's going to be leading us in government. One of y'all are going to be president of the United States probably in the next 10 years. And I'm excited to see that happen. And so the problem still exists and I want to help be a part of that addresses it if I've got a voice, but I also want to help recognize that there's a lot of progress that's been made. And so that's why, you know, all of these things just kind of came together and, you know, Joy and I were talking, but I absolutely knew with my new podcast, I had to have you on my show. You're the one that you're kind of getting credit for kicking the hornet's nest and really getting this conversation to a point where there is no looking back. There is no point of no return. We can't dial this one back. It's been kicked and we're dealing with it. So your article states that women in legal tech, and you mentioned this earlier, admit to not, quote, self-declaring as experts on generative AI.
Right.
And you hinted on this. And it's evident by who is seen as, you know, thought leaders through LinkedIn feeds or panels, blog articles. What do you think holds women back? You talked about the classroom situation. We're talking about this because of your article and Nikki Shaver's post and Bob Ambrogi's top 100. Why are women holding back? We're not. We're sitting here doing this, and this is going to be, you know, published and it's going to be out there. So, but why are the women holding back, Aisha?
Oh, I wish I had the answer to that. I think that, very true what you mentioned. So much is cultural. So much is dependent on your race, your ethnicity, you know, who you're surrounded by. So a disclaimer with, you know, all of that, and just thinking about women as a blanket statement, I don't know. I mean, I think it's considered unfeminine to kind of push to the front of the line and, you know, or raise your voice or act out. And a lot of times being passionate or being the first one to say something or even just raising your hand and saying, no, I know about this. Let me be on the panel. Let me be the expert. I think that, you know, there is such a sense of self-doubt. And I would say even women in my generation, my friends and I, you know, like we talk about it all the time and we're like in our respective careers and we're always like, oh no, like I wish I'd raised my hand there. I wish I'd said, I know this, or, you know, I don't know this. And then, you know, we end up drinking wine and being like, but that one guy who didn't know what he was talking about got the spot, but it's like, he raised his hand and you didn't, you know? And I think that it comes down to self-doubt. I think it comes down to this really kind of internalized idea of femininity And I don't speak for all women. You know, I don't speak of women for women of all ethnicities and all backgrounds. Like, I absolutely not. You know, everybody has their own experience. And I think that it's just important to hear everyone's experience and kind of go from there. That would be my answer.
I agree with you on the fear thing, and there definitely is a fear of how are people going to, I'm a woman and I'm supposed to check off these five things because I'm a woman. This is how I'm supposed to be. I'm supposed to be submissive. I'm supposed to take a second seat. I'm supposed to be taken care of. I'm not supposed to be strong. I can be, but don't tell anybody, right? But I think the root of that fear is worrying about how people are going to judge us or label us. But then you have to ask your own question, why does that matter to you? Why does it matter to you? What is your path? Who are you? What is your career? Where are you going? What do you want to make of that?
Right.
So anyway, I don't want to get down into the psychology. This is such a great conversation, but I want to talk a little bit more about your article. In your article, you wrote, and I'm going to read this, perhaps the most pervasive effect of this inequity is its translation into conversations had behind closed doors about whose product to choose when law firms are buying tech, which founder to invest angel money in, and who to promote to the C-suite when the time comes. What evidence do we have that these conversations had behind closed doors are actually happening?
So, most of the interviews that I did for the Boys Club article are off the record because folks don't really want to point to specific people, but I'm going to try to make it as anonymized as I can. What we heard from sources was this idea that, for example, there was one person and she, you know, she had been in conversation with this one law firm for her tech to potentially be used and invested in. And it was a super long kind of a, you know, a long pitching process. This was a woman who was new to the industry and you know, it was a startup. And, you know, she describes how grueling it was and kind of how, you know, the really challenging and prejudiced conversations she had at times with partners and ultimately, this particular law firm went with another tool, kind of overnight, which was a very new, you know, much newer startup with folks who were not originally necessarily technologists, but they were, you know, they were white guys who were kids of many of the partners' friends. And this is all hearsay. Of course, this is all, you know, what, but we heard stories like that enough times that, that, you know, it was verified that this was an issue that existed. And it kind of seeps into this idea of, you know, like we have conversations with law firm partners who are women all the time. And, you know, they say that, well, like women kind of get promoted and get the title, but the work they're doing is still work that you would ask an assistant to do. And then they're also doing the partner work. And it's kind of there's, but because nobody wants to go on the record or nobody's able to go on the record, it's a really hard issue to kind of get data on. It's a really hard issue to keep publishing about, because I would love to do more stories about it. You know, that like, there's so many stories if all the conversations I had off the record were able to be on the record. And I hope that was not too ambiguous an answer, but yeah, that's my
no,
answer.
I think it was appropriate, given your role and protecting these stories and these people and these companies. So I'm thinking of things too, and you know, I'm thinking of like and we don't necessarily have to answer this, but you know, food for thought for the audience is, you know, what kind of criteria is going into making an evaluation of what kind of technology a firm may need? What kind of sales process is the person who's pitching their product going through? What kind of research are they doing? Do they understand the client? Are we sure that the technology is actually the right fit for the pain that the law firm has and they're looking for a particular solution to solve this problem? You know, there's a lot of criteria that goes into solving that. So, but I also hear what you're saying, that you had enough stories of the same message. There's obviously a theme, and it mirrors a theme that we've had for decades, that we need to address this issue. So
that's right. It isn't as simple as, oh, you know, this woman's tool wasn't chosen and this guy's tool was chosen. Like, there's so much more context there. And ultimately, you know, who's to judge? Like, it's the partners who might just say, no, look, this tool's just better. And already legal tech procurement is such a complicated and difficult process, which is another story or another 100 stories. But yes, you know, when we're talking about whose tool gets chosen, it's such a nuanced question, and it's hard to answer. But all we can do is really give voice to people who say, look, I feel like something unfair has been done to me, you know?
So, mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's talk about Nikki Shaver's post. It raised the alarm around Gen AI mantles and how many legal AI experts in crowdsource lists happen to be men. And it's even evident in the U.S. government's new AI regulatory panel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was all over the news, right? So why do you believe the decision makers are placing more value on those who create the technology versus those who teach businesses how to leverage the technology?
I think the most obvious answer would be that the technology is so new, everybody has many, many questions. And there's engineers and there's folks who have backgrounds in engineering who say, look, this is how it works, and let me explain it to you. So people do believe that the folks who are influencers or who are most reliable about how the technology works are people who build it, you know. And I think that necessarily doesn't have anything to do with gender. I really think that it's kind of, you know, it's kind of how people view the most reliable sources behind explaining this technology that's really complicated and really new and really powerful. But where it becomes gendered is actually Planet Money by NPR did an amazing podcast about this, I'm going to say a couple of years ago. And it was, I think, probably in the 80s, you know, they kind of talk about the drop in women students who are studying engineering and its effects to today. And, you know, they cite all kinds of reasons, like there were times when there was only one computer in the house and it was placed in the brother's room as opposed to the sister's room, like little things like that, that kind of, you know, evolve into a systemic issue where they're the ones who build things tend to be men and the ones who don't tend to be women right now. And that's changing. You know, we've reported on women who are building the technology, and it's totally getting there. But I do think that like pervasive effect of, well, he's building it, I get it, I'm a guy, he's a guy, like, it's just easier. Why not just choose them? You know? So I think that would be my very long answer to your question. Yeah.
I think it makes sense to go to the person who built the technology first.
Right.
That has nothing to do with gender, unless it just doesn't.
Right.
Technology first. When you, and it comes out, we have questions, we're going to go to the person who built it first. The rest of us figuring out solutions and how to leverage it can't do that without the technology actually existing.
Right.
So let's talk, that segues great into the next question. So let's talk about that. There's been a lot of news about investment in AI, a lot of money being thrown at it, a lot of the integrations. And, you know, we mentioned this earlier where there's been some chatter about like usage issues and legal issues. It's out there, but that kind of news and reporting has kind of definitely been overshadowed by the investment and the integration. So let's talk about actual use business cases, business value of AI. Where's the actual business value of AI?
It's hard to say because, like you said, a lot of the coverage, you know, has been about investment, and there's just some more and more zeros, you know, ahead of the numbers that people are investing in AI. It's really hard to answer the question, what is the business value of AI, you know, for me? But from the reporting we've done, I would say that it comes back to quality of data and ultimately, you know, the winner, quote unquote, is going to be the company that has the most data and the most high quality data. And not only that, but is able to get ahead of AI governance programs and AI audits that are coming and are soon going to be, you know, tools that regulatory agencies depend on to analyze data privacy concerns and anti-discrimination concerns and algorithms, things like that. So I think that considering all of that, it's really the folks who are the most careful and the most intelligent about maximizing the amount of quality data they can train their AI on. Because, you know, like we were talking about, it's really, you could have an incredible, incredible machine, like a shiny car. But if there isn't good quality fuel to run it, it's really difficult to do anything with it.
I think you hit the nail on the head. The quality of data is everything. It's one thing to build the technology, but leveraging it is absolutely dependent on the quality of the data. And then being able to show how to leverage the technology for business efficiencies to increase, you know, job skill sets like prompt engineering. We keep hearing that. I've seen that in job posts. I've been hearing that chatter, but I've actually seen it in job posts. I know that like law firm librarians are the ones that are being pegged to really learn about AI and how to use it efficiently. There's training sessions. Is it Alto Claro is mm-hmm. training sessions. Orrick was the first one that trained their summer associates. And now, you know, we're seeing more news about Alto Claro being hired by others to do training internally. And I know we use it here at RPC Strategies. And, you know, I wrote an article about it. It's out there. But I trained on my own stuff first, right?
Right.
And so it's really about, yes, the technology is there. It absolutely is dependent on the quality of the data. And only then can you learn how to leverage it for business efficiencies. And the business efficiencies is where we're going to see the monetization, but only on the business side, because it makes us more efficient. It's just like when 18 years ago, I was selling court reporting. And when I was being trained on how to sell the court reporting and the deposition transcripts, and my manager showed me a CD. And as a paralegal, no one ever showed me that there was a CD in the back of the transcript. And I thought, what do you mean there's a CD in the back of the transcript? If I had known there was a CD in the back of the transcript, do you understand how much time that piece of technology would have saved me with all of the things I'm doing with a deposition transcript, with the summaries, you know, the ways that we're using this transcript in, you know, motions and briefs and other, you know, depositions and trial. Like, if we know how to use the technology to be more efficient in our business practices, that's where we're monetizing it, because it's saving us time, which right. also, if we're saving time, then we can use that time we've saved to go make more money somewhere else.
Right, right. Absolutely. And I think that, you know, there's been so much talk about the fear of being replaced from AI and all of that. And, you know, I'm sure there's some truth to that, but I really think, yeah, like the folks who understand that it's an amazing tool if you leverage it correctly, are going to find the most business value out of it, as opposed to resisting or even maybe not training it so well so that it doesn't replace them, which is something we're hearing as well, which is concerning.
All right, so I have two more questions for you before we wrap this up. So let's talk about the top 100. So you've clarified for everybody that your article was catapulted by Bob Ambrogi's post about the top 100, and then Nikki jumped on that, and then you jumped on it. All right, so let's talk about the top 100 just off the top of your head, and I'm totally catching you off guard with this. So I'll let everybody know. 10 women who should be on the top 100 in legal tech and AI. Go.
Oof. There's of course Nikki Shaver, there's Nikki Black, Kat Casey, Cassie Burns, Stephanie Wilkins, who's my editor. But this isn't because of that. She really is
She
super
is.
cool.
She is. Five.
And yeah, oh, five, gosh.
Joy Holly.
Joy Holly, okay. I haven't spoken to her before, but then there's also I have to look her up, but she's the new chief AI officer for, let me look her up.
I would say Shira Wilson Griffith too. She's doing a lot of programs on practical use of AI.
Yes. Oh, Debbie Reynolds, sorry,
Debbie
the
Reynolds.
she should be on everything, because anything AI data privacy related, I just think she is brilliant, and I always fangirl over her. But wait, I have to look up this person's name. I obviously cannot remember, because I wrote this article a few months ago. Let's see. Oh, Sarah Ault, who is the Michael Best chief AI officer, and probably one of the first AI officers. You know, who's a woman at a big law firm, and Sarah Ault. I think that I had a conversation with her, and you know, she was awesome.
One more.
One more, okay, let's do it. Oh, now it's hard because there's so many. And you know, now I'm like getting nervous about leaving someone out. I'm sure people will be like, oh my gosh, I'll give you two more. Stephanie Gutos, I think, I hope I'm pronouncing her name right. Stephanie Gutos and one of the attorneys that she works with, and they wrote an incredible paper. Oh, I don't know, I can't remember her name, but I will find that name for you. But Stephanie Gutos and I'll also say Lee Tydrich, who's a professor and an attorney, and I think that she's doing brilliant work. And I rely on her as a source all the time to help me understand. But I'll, yeah, those are, oh gosh, what a mess. But yeah, I hope that those were, you know, there's so many, and I'm not qualified to choose at all. So really, you know, that's truly off the top of my head. Who I would think they know far more than I do about the industry. So.
Okay, so we talked about a lot of things today about AI and about the Boys Club, but the solution lies, Isha, in business use cases, so we can start monetizing the use of AI, and really shining a light on all of those in legal tech and AI who are raising their hand and carving themselves out as thought leaders, experts, taking a chance. It doesn't mean we have to be perfect or 100% right, but we're all learning this together. So, where do we go from here, Isha? How do we hear more from these voices? And it's not necessarily about gender, it's about thought leadership, it's about business use cases, the business value, how to monetize it. So, where do we go from here, Isha? And how do we get there to really start embracing this change that's already, this evolution that's already happening?
I think being vocal about it and talking about it, and I know that's not always easy because people are afraid of the stigma, and you know, people are afraid of repercussions, which is valid. But I think that talking about it, as well as finding ways to collect meaningful data while keeping people safe, you know, that not only talks about gender but race, which is a big part of how gender is perceived in. That's what I would say. A good data collection on DEI efforts and you know, finding ways to talk about things, finding ways. I hope more reporters give folks opportunities to even be anonymous in their articles and comment in that way. You know, whatever it takes to kind of get people's feelings out.
To get more voices heard and
to
talk about the business use cases too.
To talk about the business use cases, to talk about the ethics of AI use, and to talk about the governance that's surely coming. That's what I would say.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Isha, for joining me today on the Marketing Phoenix interview series. I was really looking forward to our conversation, and I'm really excited about getting it out to the legal tech community. Thank you to our audience for joining us. I hope that you have enjoyed our interview with Isha Marath, legal tech news reporter. My name is Melissa Rogozinski, your Marketing Phoenix. Please connect with us at RPC Strategies on LinkedIn and register for our newsletter. You can also contact us at rpc@rpcgrowthstrategies.com or 205-873-1234.